Hi, this is Linda with the Talking Information Center. Thanks for joining me for the next hour, reading from the February 2025 issue of Harper's Magazine. Beginning with Easy Chair, Expect More Bulldozings by Matthew Karp. Donald Trump's second victory cannot be attributed to any unhappy accident of 18th century constitutionalism. This time, he won not only the Electoral College, that antique curiosity, but the popular vote as well. In the end, Trump's national margin over Kamala Harris was just 1.5%, narrow in the manner of all mandates within our entrenched politics. Yet even this slender triumph was disorienting to his Democratic opponents, who had again staked everything on the notion that Trump was fundamentally unacceptable to the American people. Somehow, this year, they were even more wrong than they had ever been before. After such a campaign and such a result, one natural response was a revival of the classic Brechtian proposal to dissolve the people and elect another. For the columnist Jill Filipovic, this election was not an indictment of Kamala Harris. It was an indictment of America. Our mistake, wrote Rebecca Solnit, was to think we lived in a better country than we do. Such proclamations reflect a deep unease with the basic concept of representative democracy, a foundational, if sometimes dormant, element of liberalism itself that was reactivated in 2016 and is likely to assume larger proportions during the second Trump administration. At least dramatic proclamations of this kind have the virtues of candor and comprehensiveness. Elsewhere, Trump's manifold opponents struggled to produce even a partial theory that might explain the results and also let themselves off the hook. This was a difficult business because the 2024 election, which amounted to something like a working-class revolt against the Democratic Party, drove a bulldozer through every paradigm. As Trump claimed victory, many left-of-center pundits returned to their favorite talking point from 2016. The indelible racism and misogyny of the American public. Yet as the deadpan blogger Matt Brunig delights in observing, the raw majority of Trump voters have always been women and people of color. In this year's election, virtually every demographic in the country shifted toward Trump. Younger women, unmarried women, non-white women, indeed all women, Latinos, African Americans, Asian Americans, Native Americans, and Arab Americans. As an explanation for why Joe Biden won but Harris lost, with Trump athwart what may be the most racially diverse Republican coalition since Ulysses S. Grant, mass bigotry leaves something to be desired. The very weakest explanations perhaps blame the media. Here the usual boogeymen, Fox News, Christian radio, etc., now shared space with Elon Musk's X and an array of bro content on social media whose otherworldly powers, in between ads for Me Undies and Nootropic Chewing Gum, had magticked tens of millions of Americans into believing that the economy was bad when actually it was good. There were calls to build a, quote, liberal Joe Rogan, as if Rogan himself was some kind of hard-right intellectual rather than an agreeable goof who endorsed Bernie Sanders in 2020. As if no one remembered the George W. Bush era, when the rise of conservative talk radio produced six shining years of Air America, as if liberals really lost this election because they didn't have enough podcasts. Less preposterous, but not much more edifying, was the inevitable ideological crossfire. Harris was, quote, too progressive, said centrists. She did not do enough to shed the label of an out-of-touch San Francisco liberal. She should have picked pragmatic Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro for her VP nominee instead of the mushy Tim Walz. She was torpedoed by an activist infrastructure that had tied her to unpopular positions in the 2020 primary and did not let her repudiate them in 2024. Yet these complaints ring hollow in the mouths of a commentariat that spent the election season boasting that Kamala Harris's centrism was working. This was a campaign, after all, that did all it could to massage the fluffy plumage of the never-Trump Republican columnist class. Watching Harris's speech, rhapsodized Bill Kristol in the days before the election, after Harris delivered her closing argument, I wasn't merely comfortable with my vote for her. I've got to say that I was proud to be a Harris voter. Right then and there, we should have known she was doomed. Progressives, of course, had their own share of postmortem talking points. In pursuit of the vanishing moderate Republican, Harris had embraced the Cheney family and other pillars of a bankrupt establishment. She waffled pathetically on Israel's mass killing in Gaza, alienating young people and Arab voters in Michigan. She harped on threats to the Constitution, but offered no positive reform agenda. As we might expect, the left's critique cut sharper than the center's. Critique is what we are good at, and this election wasn't our baby anyway. But that is part of the problem. In November 2016, fresh from the thrill of an unexpected primary struggle, it was not only satisfying, but genuinely plausible to affirm that Bernie would have won. This year is different. After a much less exhilarating defeat in 2020, and the mass base of the Sanders left reduced to little more than a fractional protest movement, few have sought to reawaken the old battle cry. Does anyone believe that a presidential campaign run by today's Democratic Socialists of America could have come close to beating Trump? The economic press, meanwhile, alighted on a more cold-blooded explanation for Trump's return. As in Britain, Japan, and elsewhere, voters had simply turned away from an incumbent party with the misfortune of being in power during the post-COVID inflation surge of 2021-22. For the first time in over a century, reported the Financial Times, every governing party facing election in a developed country this year lost vote share. This is important context of critical use in deflating the many hyperboles about Trump's uniquely sinister appeal. Yet the broadest version of the argument, it's the inflation stupid, risks whitewashing the character of the American turn against Biden and Harris, which was far from evenly spread or socially uniform. According to exit polls, Harris either held or increased Democratic support with a number of notable constituencies. White men with college degrees, voters with postgraduate educations, voters in households earning more than $100,000 a year, and voters in households earning more than $200,000 a year. In other words, Harris managed to retain the new core of the Democratic base, the highly educated professional class. Given the strong political headwinds, the national swing against her was greater than 6 points. This was no small accomplishment. Almost anyone else, however, moved in the other direction, especially within the working classes. The Trumpward shift of voters without college degrees was 9 points, larger than the national shift. For non-white voters without degrees, it was 16 points. Voters in households making less than $50,000, 11 points. And voters in union households, 12 points. On the map, the class character of the shift was equally unmistakable. In Massachusetts, for example, Democrats' enormous margins in wealthy Boston suburbs like Newton and Wellesley receded by 5 points or less. But in the historic industrial center of Lowell, home to some of the first factories in the United States, the decline was 11 points. In New Bedford, the hard luck whaling port where Herman Melville went to sea, it was 16. In the old mill town of Lawrence, largely Hispanic and working class, the swing toward Trump was a whopping 31 points. After 2016, metropolitan reporters packed their carry-on bags and went on safari in the Rust Belt, filing anthropological dispatches from dive bars and roadside diners in exotic locations like Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, and Saginaw, Michigan. This year, the job was easier. They hopped on the R train down to Sunset Park in Brooklyn, or took the 4 up to Yankee Stadium, where scores of ordinary New Yorkers, immigrants and children of immigrants from Asia, Latin America, and the Middle East, explained why they had decided to vote for Trump. Fundamentally, the election witnessed a rebellion of working Americans squeezed by rising prices. The Biden administration boasted that strong employment and wage gains negated the impact of inflation, but their measuring sticks, as the progressives' bete noire Larry Summers has noted, excluded the price of credit, a major omission in an economy built on housing loans and other financing costs. The combined inflation rate of food and fuel, meanwhile, reached in 2022 levels unseen since 1980. Housing, groceries, and gasoline, of course, are the costs that working Americans experience most keenly in their day-to-day lives. The fact that inflation rates declined in 2023, another factor much touted by liberal economists, was little consolation given that actual food prices, for instance, remained 25% higher than they had been before the advent of COVID-19. On election day, 68% of voters said the economy was not good, and 70% of those who said so voted for Trump. After half a century of class delinement, it was not exactly a surprise to see another wave of workers abandon the Democratic Party. Given the state of the economy, many liberals knew this might happen. Even as Democratic pundits blamed popular discontent on ignorance, misinformation, and bad partisan vibes, the party's own data analysts recognized the reality of widespread frustration. In response, Harris and her super PACs poured their lavish resources into digital and television ads aimed at a disenchanted working class. "I'm not rich as hell," an assortment of ordinary voters told the camera after a clip showed Trump boasting about giving tax cuts to his donors. Yet they paired this big spend on pseudo-populist politics with a quieter effort to reassure Wall Street and Silicon Valley that a Harris administration would be open for business. Here, the word of Harris's brother-in-law, Tony West, the chief legal officer at Uber, and certifiably, quote, rich as hell, was worth 1,000 TV commercials. After a brief honeymoon period over the summer when Harris mocked Trump instead of denouncing him, the campaign gave way to a more familiar Democratic posture of ethical rectitude enlivened by flutters of hysteria. Harris painted Trump as a criminal, a moral abomination, a would-be dictator whose dangerous rhetoric should disqualify him from office. Meanwhile, she showcased her celebrity endorsements and lambasted Trump on abortion, confident that the Dobbs decision had changed the American electorate for good by galvanizing pro-choice voters. In the end, the $1.6 billion operation was a bust, the most expensive failure in American political history. Yet the impulse to proclaim Kamala Harris a bad candidate should be avoided. Who would have been better? Gavin Newsom, Pete Buttigieg, Josh Shapiro and his embarrassing Obama impersonation? Gretchen Whitmer, the victor of two low-turnout midterm elections, whose political wizardry this cycle involved a bizarre TikTok video that mocked Holy Communion with Doritos. These are interchangeable parts in a broken machine. The fault is not in the Democrats' campaigns. It's in it themselves. This is a party that represents the nerve center of American capitalism, ideological production, and imperial power. Elon Musk's contributions notwithstanding, in just 3 months, Harris raised far more money than Trump from a much broader and deeper bench of wealthy elites. This is a party that embodies a contented American status quo. Its faultless constitution, its dynamic opportunity economy, its indispensable role as military policeman of the global order. And this is a party for which everything is either righteously moral or bloodlessly technical, but for which nothing is political, that is, alert to real questions of power and subject to actual popular contestation. It is no coincidence that the past three Democratic nominees for president did not emerge from any kind of political process, but were pre-selected by fellow elites. Anointed is, in fact, the correct word for the actions of a party of such aristocratic manner and apolitical self-regard. Barack Obama anointed Hillary Clinton in 2016, and then, in a crunch, Joe Biden in 2020. Biden, in turn, anointed Harris when he stepped down. Squashing the Sanders insurgency was one thing, since the rebels were all outside the castle, but this is a party that simply does not welcome internal ideological debate. Even the decision to run those populist TV ads were driven not by conviction or popular demand, but by data scientists at the helm of focus groups. Given the billion-dollar muscle behind Harris's campaign and the barrenness of her actual economic agenda, which promised a working people tax cut and vague efforts to stop price gouging, it is no surprise that the ads failed to convince many working-class voters. No doubt they struck many as hypocritical. The Democrats today recalled the Whigs lacerated by Marx in 19th-century Britain, another liberal party tied to an arrogant economic elite. They, too, are moneymongers with feudal prejudices, aristocrats without point of honor, bourgeois without industrial activity, finality men with progressive phrases, progressists with fanatical conservatism, traffickers in homeopathical fractions of reforms. It was a strange, strange assemblage. Hillary Clinton and Dick Cheney, Mark Cuban and Sean Fain, Bill Kristol and Beyonce. Left liberal think tanks touting the greatest economy ever, even as labor's share of national income remains lower than it was before the pandemic. Harris pledging to take on big corporations while raking in unprecedented billions in dark money from the corporate investor class. The mass of the English people, wrote Marx, have a sound, aesthetical common sense. They have an instinctive hatred against everything motley and ambiguous. So, too, the American people. In this election, Democrats asserted their moral authority while making an elaborate effort to whisper away their vast economic power. Trump, in contrast, boasted of his wealth and pretended to no virtue beyond his own advancement. His chief promises to the people, a closed border, high tariffs, and low taxes, depended not on his character, but on his capacities. Trump will fix it. Even after Trump's victory, it is far from clear that this program was the first choice of the electorate. Across the country, populist Democrats who decried rather than celebrated the inflammatory economy, who blamed a class enemy, the corporate elite, rather than a partisan one, who set aside the NGO-approved culture war in favor of material focus, ran well ahead of Harris. In Nebraska, Dan Osborne, an independent union steamfitter running for a Senate seat, outran the National Democratic ticket by almost 14 points, a margin large enough to have won any of the seven swing states, Ohio or Florida. These populists were not progressives, at least not in the juvenile two-dimensional conception of American politics. Beginning with a political argument rather than a moral code, they avoided unpopular positions on energy, immigration, and gender policy. Yet unlike Harris, they did not campaign alongside the same plutocrats they denounced in their TV ads. They did not lament on unfair status quo while also auditioning to maintain it. When Osborne attacked the millionaires and the billionaires in the Senate, you had the distinct sense that he actually meant it. Until Democrats can find a way to mean it too, they can expect more bulldozings. And now from the readings column. This is a fiction piece called Talking Horse by Allie Smith from Glyph, which will be published this month by Pantheon. How do you say hello to a horse? I said. I'll show you, my sister said. We were standing in the early morning, the air already thickening with mist, some of which seemed to be rising off the back of the horse. Someone called Arkin had cleared a patch of the playing field yesterday with a lawnmower, and together the small group of people who lived here had helped us clear everything from it that might harm a horse. The makeshift fence round the cleared space was made of a lot of old classroom chairs and tables shoved up against one another in the big oblong. Two small, feral-looking kids, ragged, both looked about 7 years old, had been told off several times for knocking some of these flimsy chairs to one side as if to let the horse out. This morning, some of the chairs were lying on their sides on the grass, and the fence was full of openings. But the horse was still there in the enclosure, as if perfectly happy to be there, and was now coming slowly across the shorter grass toward us in the mist. I leaned on the back of one of the still-standing chairs. It could easily just walk out of there, I said, and it hasn't. My sister shrugged. I told him last night I'd come and get him this morning and that we'd take him in before it got too hot today, she said. Yeah, but how much does a horse understand of what you're saying? I said. I mean, what did it, what did he really know when you were telling him that? You say hello like this, she said. She stretched her arm out as the horse came near, her hand held toward the tip of its nose. Not that he doesn't also hear when you use words, she said. Hello, Glyph. The horse put his nose into her hand. Even though there were already several possible ways through the furniture fence, my sister shifted the two chairs directly in front of us so the horse could come out through the opening she made, and he did. Came walking beside us all the way across the high, dry grass to the building, then over the old car park space, the tarmac already softening underfoot this early under the sun, then easily up the broad school steps and in. The noise of him, even just slow walking inside the building, rang above us like weird magic all through the corridor and into the big hall. "You stay here with him while I sort this," my sister said. I pulled myself up to sit on the edge of the stage, swung my legs, watched the horse just standing in all the empty space, shifting his weight from hoof to hoof, head low to the parquet. My sister went back and forth between here and the toilets, bringing half pailfuls of water, one on each arm, and pouring them into the things that people here had given us. A plastic bucket found in the cleaning cupboard, the plastic hood of the lawnmower, two large plastic storage tubs that looked like recycling bins. The hall was cool and still. The horse stood, closed his eyes, and what morning light came through the glass of the rusty skylights in the roof. One skylight was broken. Below it, all down the wall, all the way to the floor, was the stain of past rain. This was a room from when children in the old days all learned things at once together in one building. The people who lived here now were Una. Valentina Meany and her friend Arkin. They were in charge of the fence and the upkeep of things. Uliana, who knew about the sublime. A thin, clever man called Burton. He was missing a finger on one hand. He said he'd caught it in a fence underwater and it had had to choose whether to leave it behind or drown. The girl who'd called me a cat and told me the big dogs would get me. Her name was Daisy. A 15-year-old boy called Wolf, whose job description, my sister and I decided, was to be as sullen as possible. The two wild, silent children with the ragged clothes and hair, one was called Little, and I never found out the other's name. Why was it different calling a person something from calling a horse a name? It was different, subtly different, but subtly the same, too. I'd never thought about it before, and why did I myself really like having more than one name, as if I had more than one self? Why were my sister and I so careful and keen to evade when we told people our names? Evade what? Why did we so often naturally know to tell them names that weren't our names at all? And why did doing this leave us reeling with happiness? And why was any of this related to saying hello to a horse? Or giving a horse as a name just some word, a meaningless word like Glyph, from then on supposed to mean that individual horse, whether the horse knew it or not? Last night, Unad ushered us to what said on the door it was a headmaster's office. We were carrying our rucksacks and kitchen stuff and what was left of our cans. It had been a badge of honor, us arriving complete with a horse. It had made us unusually interesting. This is Briar, also known as Bryce, and this is Rose of Allendale. That's not my name, my sister said to the room. Then my sister and I had been made to sit on the most comfortable seats in the place and were given so much food to eat we couldn't finish all of it. Afterward, Una had sung an old song about clear, fair mornings, a calm sea, somebody at your side when you go wandering. There were a lot of flowers in the song. It was a song about flowers, really, and about somebody whose name wasn't Rose, but who becomes a kind of symbolic rose to the singer. The singer is a person who's been east and west and never been alone because of this rose coming with them wherever they are. When the singer's boat is wrecked by sea storms, the rose alone withstands the storms. When the singer is fevered and thirsty in desert sand, the rose keeps the singer alive by telling them stories of all the other possible places, all the happinesses. At the end, the singer says their life would have been nothing if they hadn't had the Rose of Allendale in their life. "I take it back," my sister said when she heard it. "I am Rose of Allendale." Everybody except the small children raised their cups and glasses to Bryce/Briar and Rose of Allendale. It was embarrassing, but also lovely, like we had a brightness around us, like we might really matter to a room full of people we didn't know. And Ona Nad sung that song with an unfussy voice that sounded as sturdy as a well-made wooden table, and it was the first time I'd understood that the thought of an ordinary wooden table could itself be a kind of comfort. They took us to another room on the ground floor. It said nurse's office on the door. They gave us clean bedding and made us up beds that were quite like real beds. One up on high legs, one on the floor with pillows and such. The water in this building could be hot, too, and was plentiful. There were showers that still worked. We were clean again. We'd eaten rice, cheese, actual vegetables. Lucky for my sister, who'd eaten nothing but sweet corn for the past couple of days, the people here made real food in what had once been rooms where young people were taught how to make meals, where some ovens and hobs still worked, at least when the electricity was working. Valentina always knew how to get it working again, and her friend Arkin, who had a beard so long he tied it up in a knot at the top of his head to keep it out of the way we was working or eating, was always sorting the rubble where bits of the building had fallen in on themselves and trying to make it watertight before the big storms came. They were coming soon. They always did after the heat. "We could stay until we were ready to move on," Juliana had told us last night. "Could we shelter the horse from the sun somewhere?" Yes, in what was called the assembly hall. But when we'd seen it with the good wooden floor, we'd exchanged glances with each other. My sister had said two words, "horse piss, horse shit." Valentina had laughed and said, "We don't care. We never use this room. We'll christen it Horse Hall at the first piss," she said. All the people living here, including the feral children, were right now unverifiables. They were largely unverifiable because of words. One person here had been unverified for saying out loud that a war was a war when it wasn't permitted to call it a war. Another had found herself declared unverifiable for writing online that the killing of many people by another people was a genocide. Another had been unverified for defaming the oil conglomerates by saying they were directly responsible for climate catastrophe. Another had been unverified for speaking at a protest about people's right to protest. The ferals had been marked unverifiable simply because nobody knew what had happened to their adults, and it couldn't be proved who they were. My sister came back, water slopping. The buckets she was carrying made her look even smaller. I jumped down to help. "I've got it," she said. "I'm doing it." "What's the point?" I said. "Horses need a lot of water." "No, I mean, what's the point in calling a horse a name?" I said. She looked at me like I was speaking a language she didn't understand. "He's mine," she says. "Ours. We call him what we like." "Yeah, but that is what a name is, another word for ownership. When really, you giving our money to a boy who says he or his father or whoever owns this horse, well, it doesn't really make this horse, if we look at it from the horse's world view, any more their horse, your horse, or our horse," I said. "What's another word for mad?" she said. "Deranged," I said. "You're deranged," she said. "But isn't you calling you can own it, or him, and call him a name, sort of deranged too? And isn't it in fact exactly the same in some ways as the other people who have called him other names before in his lifetime and thought they could decide what to do with his life, ride him, treat him well or badly, send him to a slaughterhouse?" My sister rolled her eyes. "Uh-huh, whatever," she said. She left the room with the empty pails on her arm. Soon, everybody else in the place would wake up, and this hall would be full of the people who lived here, coming to hang out with what they all called our horse. I went and stood closer to the our horse. "I'm Bree. I'm deranged. More trouble than it's worth," I said. "What are you?" He opened one eye at me, then shut it again, lowered his head, breathed out wetly right onto me. "You don't need a name, do you?" I said. He didn't, any more than the dog we called Rogi, that had lived with us for a time, then vanished, presumably got on with his life elsewhere while we went on with ours without him, was ever really anything to do with the name we'd called him. So there was the word that made the name, and there was the dog that it conjured in the mind, and there, way beyond it, totally free of it of himself, was the real dog wagging or not wagging his tail. It was me who was tethered to the word. "What do you make of your new field? We have to keep you out of the sun, but you'll be able to go back out late today when it cools and be out at night, and we're sorting horse food for in here, I mean feed, as well as the grass you can eat out there, and we're working out how to pay for it. We don't know what we're going to do or how, but we're going to do it." The horse stood, indifferent. "What's a horse's day like?" I said. "What's it like being a horse at night? Can you see in the dark, like cats and owls? What was it like last night in that moonlight? What's it like if you're out in a field and it starts to rain? Do you mind? Does it feel good? Unpleasant? Does horsehair keep the rain off? Do you prefer it when it's cold out? Do you prefer it when it's cold out or hot? Can you feel heat like you did feel the heat on the tarmac when we came in? Can you feel it through your hooves? Do hooves feel? What was your life like before us? What are horse memories like? Where do you live? Who was your mother? What was she like? Who was your father? Do horses care about fathers or mothers? How come you ended up in that abattoir field? Who owned you and did that to you? I mean, who thought they owned you?" Nothing. "Glyph," I said. I said it to see how it felt. I patted his neck like my sister had shown me how to. "Good glyph," I said. And now a letter from Texas, a good company searching for my publisher's radioactive oil waste by Justin Noble. Justin Noble is the author of Petroleum-238, Big Oil's Dangerous Secret and the Grassroots Fight to Stop It. Out in the country, north of New York City, Carrot and I cut a pathway through reeds and wildflowers, and one day drove to the end of it in an old Fleetwood Bounder, parked under a black oak tree, and moved in. This was in the summer of 2020. There was a major river nearby, mountains across the way, and a small town with a few stores. We had no electricity or running water, but the RV had a minibar, a coffee maker, and a DVD player. We set up an outdoor shower and hooked up solar panels. Carrot worked at her atelier in a nearby store, and I worked on a book I had been writing for years about radioactive oil and gas waste. While my job as a journalist drew me toward the problems of industrialized society, here we tracked the sun and saw stars fall from the sky, and I biked the country roads at night under Cassiopeia, the spotlight moon, and even pitch black, realizing that freedom meant having the privilege to take a risk and glide through the dark, nearly blind. Then, one early August day in 2023, the material world intruded in the form of an email from my publisher. It read, "Dear Simon and Schuster Arthur, author, I'm delighted to announce that Paramount Global has agreed to a sale of Simon & Schuster to KKR, one of the world's largest and most respected investment firms. Over the 3 years since the sale process initially began, we've had the privilege of meeting with numerous interested buyers. In the spring of 2023, we began a series of fascinating and stimulating conversations with members of KKR's media and entertainment industry team about every aspect of our business, reflective of their keen interest in acquiring our company. All of us from Simon & Schuster who participated came away from those conversations impressed by KKR's acumen, as well as their team's desire to help our business grow and thrive in the future. I knew nothing about KKR, but I soon learned that it was a private equity company headquartered in New York. It had significant assets in oil and gas, receiving a D rating on a climate risk scorecard put out in 2022 by a financial reform group, as well as investments in a pipeline going through land of the Wet Sweeten in British Columbia. The firm had connections to a nonprofit that had pushed Republican state treasurers to squash investments in renewables and promote oil and gas interests. And it had formed in 2021 its own oil and gas exploration and production company called Crescent Energy, with assets in the Rocky Mountains and South Texas. Shortly after learning of the deal, I spoke with Lynn, a friend of mine who worked at a farm market. She told me how it was with organic food companies. Naked Juice, purchased in 2006 by PepsiCo Company, Annie's, now part of General Mills, Kashi, owned by Kellogg, Honest Tea and Odwalla, both swallowed by Coca-Cola. I also mentioned the purchase to a friend of my sister's who used to work for WebMD. She told me that KKR bought it, things got worse, and then she left. That my book had ended up in the lap of the very thing I was investigating was stunning to me, but few others seemed surprised. I waited for Simon & Schuster's high-profile authors to raise a word of complaint, but as far as I could see, none did. I monitored Stephen King's social media accounts, thinking that he, who had stood up to defend writers a few years earlier when Penguin Random House had attempted to purchase Simon & Schuster, might say something. Crickets. In the absence of any prominent outrage, I wondered what responsibility fell to me. My book, Petroleum 238, Big Oil's Dangerous Secret and the Grassroots Fight to Stop It, due to be published by Simon & Schuster the following spring, was the product of a seven-year investigation into the radioactivity brought to the surface by oil and gas development, and the various threats it posed to the industry's workers, the public, and the environment. KKR's purchase of Simon & Schuster meant that the book would be owned by a publishing house that was owned by a private equity company that owned an oil and gas company. A few days after my receiving the email, I spoke to my editor over the phone and told him I intended to pull the book. The decision came with that uncomfortable, hollow feeling you get when you know you're making an irreversible choice. I would have to return to Simon & Schuster the $30,000 of the advance I had received. It also likely meant that fewer people would read the book, which threatened the impact I wanted it to have in the first place. I suppose I wanted proof beyond climate risk scorecards that I had been right to sever ties with the company. I wanted to see the thing that I had reacted to up close. It just so happened that one of my sources, Sister Elizabeth Reibslager, an 80-year-old nun, lived in Texas near some of KKR's Crescent Energy wells. I gave her a call. To be a writer is to want the world to care, and the first task is getting someone to print your words. What I didn't realize when I started, when I chose to get degrees in earth and environmental science and journalism, when I wrote for small newspapers, then online literary journals, then bigger ones with printed pages, is that if you actually succeed, you can lose track of yourself. Soon enough, the writing becomes the life. I've long been a great admirer of your work and would be absolutely thrilled to work with you on something, read the message I received from Sean, who was an editor at a national magazine. This, I was learning, is how freelance journalism works. You anxiously send your stories out into the void, and editors find them, read them, and ask you to write bigger things for larger publications, ones that pay better but often have just a little less soul. You would be a fool to not take the opportunity, because in the end, the words are what matter, and you want people to see them, and you need money. So I wrote for Sean, a story about a Utah truck driver who hauled potatoes and built a telescope the size of his truck through which he could see the rings of planets, and another one about a rich Russian adventurer who crashed a helicopter into Arctic sea ice. There were freaky geniuses stuck on the outer edges of the earth, while the egotists ran the core. The former, I realized, were my people. But I couldn't disregard the battle between earth and ego, and so I became interested in fracking. I had spent years covering rising seas, melting ice, and offshore spills, but the controversial drilling technique was new to me. To better understand it, I took a tour in 2018 through the Marcellus and the Utica black shale formations that underlie northern Appalachia and represent one of America's booming natural gas production zones. I met sick workers who had been doused with fracking waste and a person who had lived for months in the treetops to block a natural gas pipeline's passage through a pristine forest. I learned about injection wells, where wastewater that gushes to the surface is shot back into the deep earth. I started working on my book when Tish Odell, an Ohio community organizer, told me that a company in the Cleveland area had made a liquid de-icer out of radioactive oil and gas waste, though it was supposedly safe for the environment and pets and was being sold at Lowe's for use on home driveways and patios. The U.S. oil and gas industry generates a trillion gallons of oil field brine per year. Put into barrels and laid end to end, it would reach to the moon and back nearly 29 times. Brine can contain elevated levels of heavy metals like lead and arsenic, and often so much radium that under certain Environmental Protection Agency guidelines, it would be classified as radioactive waste. A brine hauler I met named Richard had sneaked samples out of his truck and stashed them in his backyard shed. 10 or 15 years down the road, if I get sick, he told me, I want to be able to prove this. Oil and gas waste can accumulate as a wildly radioactive sludge at the bottom of brine tanks and trucks, which can be mixed with coal ash or ground up corn cobs in a dastardly attempt to cloak its toxicity. It can take the form of drilling waste, which in Oklahoma has been spread across farmland under the misguided belief that it's good for crops and cows. Much of this waste arrives at facilities where workers attempt to treat and clean it, but often end up concentrating the radioactivity and becoming contaminated themselves. Jesse Lombardi, a former bank robber from Ohio, who became a fracking waste manager and later a whistleblower, joined me and a former Department of Energy scientist on a mission to scout out these treatment facilities. In West Virginia, we found a site more radioactive than 99% of the Chernobyl exclusion zone. We saw a mattress floating in a moat of radioactive water surrounded by discarded beer cans and condoms. Man, Jesse said, we polluted the living fuck out of this place. In 2019, some years after Sean had become an editor at Simon & Schuster, my agent sold him Petroleum 238. There were nights when I spun out on my bicycle into the dark, believing I had unearthed information that could bring the oil and gas industry to its knees and save the world from climate chaos. In these moments, I convinced myself I could go several months without sleeping to finish the book. Of course, I still had years of work ahead of me. But when I received that email from Simon & Schuster, I had to consider not just myself, but all the people whose stories I had brought home in my notebooks. The book had taken over, become its own planet, and I orbited it around it like an obedient moon. Last February, I boarded a plane in New York City, and 4.5 hours later descended over a terrain of thorn scrub to touch down on the tarmac in San Antonio, a gateway to the Eagle Ford Shale, an oil and gas-bearing geologic formation that slinks like a snake northeast from the Mexican border. This is the terrain that Sister Elizabeth knows best. She first helped me traverse it on a reporting trip in 2019. KKR's Crescent Energy had acreage in places I hadn't yet seen, in a remote western part of the formation near the border. Sister Elizabeth and I had decided not just to locate the wells, but as best as we could to determine where the waste was ending up. This would be the proof I was looking for that Crescent Energy, meaning KKR, meaning Simon & Schuster, was marred by an ungodly liability. Proof that I hadn't given up everything for nothing. Driving white Nissan Rogue, Sister Elizabeth texted me as I stepped out of the airport. She pulled up wearing a pair of black wraparound sunglasses and a headset fit for an air traffic controller, which she used to take hands-free calls from her activist contacts flung far and wide across the great petroleum-contaminated state of Texas. A small jeweled cross hung over her heart. Sister Elizabeth was born on the ninth day of the ninth month at 9:09 in the morning in 1936. At 18, inspired by a passionist priest she heard speak at a mission in Cuero, Texas, she was accepted as a candidate into the Order of the Sisters of Charity of the Incarnate Word, who arrived in Galveston in 1866 from Lyon, France, to tend to those sick with cholera and yellow fever. Sister Elizabeth believes that we have a spiritual connection to the earth and a moral obligation to protect it. After the reforms of the Second Vatican Council enabled nuns like her to drop the habit, live in apartments rather than convents, and focus on social justice issues beyond caring for the sick, poor, and elderly, Sister Elizabeth began to understand the abuse of capitalism and the loss of spiritual values that affected the economic systems of the West like a cancer, as she once put it to me. When fracking came to South Texas, she recognized it as a point where the capitalist motor of America ran up against her commitment to the earth. She decided to observe the industry, learn about it, and reflect on the environmental science and technology of fracking in the light of the gospel. Sister Elizabeth has taken Russian petroleum engineers, a member of the German Green Party, college students, and journalists like myself on tours of the Eagle Ford, bringing her visitors to the sites of spills and explosions and introducing them to affected residents. She also works to help those residents understand and perhaps try to curtail the toxic infrastructure of fracking. This is how she came to help the Eagle Ford community of Nordheim, population 350, fight a landfill for oil and gas waste. The development belonged to a company called Petro Waste, founded in 2014 by a young man in commercial real estate from Midland, Texas, named George Womack. I think the best advice I'd give to anyone young who's looking to be successful in the industry, Womack once said, is don't worry about failure, because if you fall, you're probably going to fall forward. This sort of cowboy entrepreneurialism serves a critical role in dealing with, or at least attempting to deal with, oil and gas waste, as it has since the first successful commercial oil well was drilled in Titusville, Pennsylvania in 1859. Although brine, sludge, and drilling waste have been copiously spilled and spread across the country since the 19th century, and although scientists have documented extensive amounts of contamination, a 1980 federal exemption legally defines oil and gas waste as non-hazardous. Figuring out what to do with it is now a multi-billion dollar industry. When I accompanied Sister Elizabeth to Nordheim in 2019, I met the Bowmans, a ranching family whose driveway ran along the southeast edge of the Petro Waste landfill. We spent time in their front yard peering through a chain link fence, watching truck after truck dump piles of black waste, a material that could be confused for mulch you might purchase in a garden supply store. We watched excavators move it around and dust devils move it around again. In 2013, researchers in Texas found that living near drilling waste increases the risk of radiological exposure, whether from drinking toxic groundwater or eating contaminated vegetables and dairy products. Sister Elizabeth had spent years fighting with the community against the permits issued by Texas regulatory agencies to no avail. To her, Womack was not just a businessman. He's an exploiter of people, of land, of ranchers, of the environment, I recall her saying as we relaxed with the Bowmans one day in the shade of a tree. That year, Womack indeed fell forward when he sold Petro Waste to a subsidiary of Waste Management, a giant in the industry. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation Trust has over 30 million shares in it. Waste Management is relatively recession-proof, read an article in Forbes on why Gates had invested so much in the company, since people will always generate garbage. Reporting on oil and gas waste has clarified this widespread corporate tactic for me. Take a liability, transform it into a usable product, and turn it into an asset. In the late 60s, Jerome Kohlberg, Henry Kravis, and George Roberts all worked at the prestigious New York investment firm Bear Stearns. The three men honed in on an uncommon form of company takeover that came to be known as the leveraged buyout, or LBO. The tactic involves buying companies with debt while using the newly obtained assets as collateral, then stripping the company for parts, often by unloading subsidiaries and workers to repay the debt. An important aspect of these deals, noted a 1988 Fortune article, is capturing the hearts and minds of the company's managers by giving them a share of the ownership, only to sell it off later. Roberts grew up in Houston, where his father was an oil man. Kravis grew up in Tulsa as the son of a petroleum engineer. At age 17, he took his first job in the mailroom of an oil company. Well, at Bear Stearns, Kohlberg, Kravis, and Roberts tried an LBO on an oil field services company called L.B. Foster, We bought them and then proceeded to make them better than when we found them, Kravis once told an oral history organization. Not all LBO succeeded. In 1971, Kohlberg and his colleagues orchestrated a buyout of the shoe manufacturer Cobblers. Shortly after the deal went through, its president committed suicide, and then the company went bankrupt. But even in failure, the LBOers could make fabulous amounts of money through a variety of fees. The men left Bear Stearns in 1976 to found KKR, aiming to focus on ambitious LBOs, and made numerous acquisitions during the 80s buyout boom. "I'm the kind of person who could fall out of a window, land on my head," Kravis told an interviewer in a building perched above Central Park. "I might bounce a couple of times, and I'm going to come up on my feet." In 1983, Kohlberg was diagnosed with a brain tumor and underwent surgery. When he returned to KKR a year later, he found the culture had changed for the worse. His signature down-to-earth style and sense of fairness had been replaced, a friend of his later recalled, with fast-paced, hostile takeovers that included extra fees to enrich KKR. In 1987, he left the firm, stating in a final boardroom speech, "We must all insist on ethical behavior, or we will kill the golden goose." Kohlberg retired to Martha's Vineyard, where he backed sustainable farming initiatives and bought the local newspaper in a move he called an investment in preserving something that's worth preserving. Meanwhile, KKR went on to apply its LBO technique to companies that made crackers and cigarettes and that operated power grids, movie theaters, and hospital emergency rooms. The practices perfected by KKR are buying out a growing share of the American economy. Private equity, wrote Roger Karma in The Atlantic in 2023, has swallowed one-fifth of the market, and in turning public companies private, made it effectively invisible. When the fracking boom began in the aughts, KKR was quick on the scene with a purchase in 2009 of acreage in the Marcellus Formation. The next year, the firm partnered with a private company to enter the Eagle Ford, and in the years that followed made deals that gained it acreage and assets in Utah, Wyoming, Canada, and Mexico. In 2010, Natural Gas Intelligence, an industry news site, proclaimed KKR continues shale rampage. But the firm apparently wanted a more direct way to control its interests. In December 2021, KKR merged one of its companies with another in Texas to create Crescent Energy, whose shares began trading on the New York Stock Exchange, and which, according to another industry news site, would be KKR's primary platform for pursuing upstream oil and natural gas opportunities. Crescent expanded into the oil fields of Utah in 2022, and in 2023, it acquired additional assets in the Western Eagle Ford. As had become the trend, Crescent pitched the move to investors as part of the fight for a green future. Crescent is dedicated to climate, environment, safety, community, and diversity and inclusion, said David Rockecharlie, Crescent's CEO and the head of KKR's Energy Real Assets Division, in a 2022 sustainability report. KKR's venture into publishing and media had begun several years before with acquisitions and investments ranging from Overdrive, a digital reading platform for schools and libraries, to ByteDance, the Chinese tech company that owns TikTok. In March 2021, it was announced that KKR would join forces with Bertelsmann Music Group, BMG, to acquire music rights and catalogs and deliver a compelling solution for artists. BMG is part of the German company Bertelsmann, which owns America's largest publishing company, Penguin Random House, which itself tried to buy Simon & Schuster in 2022, a move that was blocked by a federal judge. The proposed merger, Jonathan Kantner, an assistant attorney general working in the Justice Department's antitrust division, said in October 22 would have reduced competition and the diversity of our stories and ideas, and ultimately impoverished our democracy. 1 year later, Simon & Schuster would be acquired by KKR. I was supposed to stay the night at the apartment of a friend of Sister Elizabeth's who lives in oil and gas country, but that contact was out of town, so after dinner, she dropped me off at a Holiday Inn Express. I spent the evening printing out maps near the waffle irons in the lobby and hand-drawing others, scribbling notes, and creating a path for us to take through Crescent's acreage. Before the trip, I had spoken with one of my industry contacts, Blake Scott, who runs a data company called Waste Analytics. I told him I was looking for Simon & Schuster's wells, meaning KKR's wells, meaning Crescent Energy's wells. Many are operated by subsidiaries, making their real footprint difficult to measure. But he pulled up a Securities and Exchange Commission document that listed each by name. Scott's expertise lies in drilling waste, which in Texas is often buried in pits at the drilling sites. The industry calls them toxic tacos, Scott told me, a reference to the way that pits are constructed with plastic liners on the bottom and sides and the waste in the middle. They can be located anywhere that drilling has occurred, and they all stand to eventually leach contaminants. Pits aren't disclosed on a property's title, meaning that thousands of American families may be living atop drilling waste without knowing it. Scott believes that these pits and the inadequate accounting of them means that properly appraising these homes could bring on something like the 2008 financial crisis, only worse. Landfills are an alternative to pits, but pile all the drilling waste in a landfill and a mountain will rise from the Texas plain. When we spoke, Scott used a mapping tool that showed every single oil and gas well in Texas and who owned them. Then he zoomed in on the Western Eagle Ford. He pulled up the list of Crescent subsidiaries, cross-referencing them with the wells on the map. The list included 65 companies, and we assumed that many of them operated the wells located in the middle of sprawling private ranches that we couldn't access. I keyed in on a stretch of County Road 3715. It was a rough-looking but accessible and surrounded by wells owned by a Crescent subsidiary, one of many it owns, with the name Javelin. The following morning, Sister Elizabeth texted me, "Do they have breakfast tacos? If they do, can you pick me up a couple?" Not tacos, but soft tortillas with scrambled eggs on the side. She had parked outside the hotel, and I handed them to her on a paper plate through the car window. Unfortunately, that concludes our hour with Harper's Magazine. Have a great day. It's Linda from the Talking Information Center.